Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is February 27, 1977, and this is my monthly audio letter number 21. For some time now, I've been warning you of the dangers facing America. Now, time is fast running out. When Jimmy Carter was inaugurated president on January 20, 1977, a contingency plan concocted in 1963 was set in motion, and it is progressing very rapidly. The key to this particular plan was to be the placement of a completely puppetized president in office at a time of rapidly mounting war threats. Under this plan, inadequate performance by the puppet presidents in the face of these dire threats is intended to enable a takeover of the country by Rockefeller-controlled military and CIA inner circles. In this manner, the total dictatorship sought by the four Rockefeller brothers is to be brought into being. We are now faced with the planned threat of nuclear war I, with the puppet president now on the scene in the person of Jimmy Carter. Carter continually spouts the Rockefeller line as he learned it from his participation in their trilateral commission, but he has no real grasp at all of what he is involved in. Meanwhile, the CIA is also being readied for its appointed role. Nelson Rockefeller has been busy packing key positions in the CIA with his new men, and to facilitate the enlistment of required military support for the coming dictatorship, a military man who is a member of the Rockefeller inner circle, Admiral Stansfield Turner, has been selected to head the CIA. That's why the earlier nomination of Ted Sorensen ran into a brick wall. He ran afoul of a game plan he didn't even know about. The plan calls for pre-war crisis measures to be used to condition Americans to accept the elaborate transformation of America into a total dictatorship, and this pre-war buildup is going on right now. Ultimately, many millions of Americans are to be annihilated in a Soviet nuclear attack, which is to be carried out according to rules laid down in secret agreements negotiated by former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger. As I revealed in monthly audio letter number 12 for May 1976, this joint Rockefeller-Soviet war plan includes a super-secret nuclear safe zone across the upper portion of the continental United States, within which the Rockefellers and their intimates plan to ride out the war on Mount Desert and Bartlett Islands off the coast of Maine, right in the heart of the nuclear safe zone. This nuclear safe zone is merely the nuclear age equivalent of the orders which were given to Allied bombing commands during World War II not to damage Rockefeller-owned strategic targets in Germany. These orders caused such huge important installations as the IG Farben chemical plants to survive unscathed all the way through World War II, while other targets and even whole cities nearby were completely leveled. Last month, in monthly audio letter number 20, I was able to reveal the club the Rockefeller brothers believe they hold over the heads of the Soviets to make sure the Soviet nuclear attack on America goes as planned. In this way, the Rockefellers will have used the Soviets to do their dirty work for them. In any event, this club consists of an undersea fleet of 14 super missiles targeted on the Soviet Union, 5 in the Pacific, 9 in the Atlantic. These missiles are not under the control of our Defense Department and have nothing whatever to do with the defense of our country as a whole. They're under the direct control of the Rockefeller brothers through their controlled CIA, and their only purpose is to make sure that the Rockefeller inner circles in America are not included in the Holocaust that is being arranged for the rest of us. If all goes as planned, The CIA super missiles deep in the ocean will never be fired at all. Only if there should be a Soviet double cross would there be an attempt to fire them, and under those circumstances they would act only as vengeance weapons. Yet as awesome as these CIA super missiles are, they cannot prevent a Soviet double cross. In fact, they have already provoked one double cross. Last summer, the Soviet Union sneaked in under the CIA missile umbrella and began planting short-range underwater-launched nuclear missiles in our own territorial waters, hoping to achieve such total surprise that the CIA undersea super missiles would never be fired. The limited exposure of this threat, which I was able to achieve by means of audio letters number 14 and 15 for July and August 1976, was sufficient to ruin the Soviet surprise. So an attack at that time was averted. The joint Rockefeller-Soviet war plan is back on track for the time being, but now both sides are watching for a chance to double-cross each other. Meanwhile, as I reported last month, the presence of the Soviet missiles in our waters are now being incorporated into the joint war plan. For the first time in many years, civil defense, of which we have none, has again become the subject of wide concern. We are again hearing radio test alerts on the emergency broadcasting system, which will be used in the event of war. It has even been hinted that we may soon experience unannounced air raid drills, a practice that could be especially effective in conditioning us all to the idea that war is imminent. Only a few days ago, on February 11, 1977, President Carter became the first president to fly with great publicity in a special airplane outfitted as a flying command post to be used in nuclear war. The article above this in the New York Daily News carried the headline, quote, "Carter gets a preview of World War III," unquote. Just a year ago, such headlines would have been unthinkable. Now they are all around us. Because the plan now underway requires that military support be arranged for the new dictatorship, it was essential that General George S. Brown, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, be neutralized, as I said he would be in monthly audio letter number 17. General Brown played a pivotal role in preventing a Soviet nuclear surprise attack on the United States during August and September 1976. But that will not happen again, my friends. The campaign, which began in October 1976 to render General Brown ineffective in his efforts to protect America, have now succeeded. He's no longer able to influence events to any significant extent. That is why, when Carter demanded on January 12, 1977, that studies be performed toward eliminating 75% to 80% of our intercontinental missiles, General Brown simply agreed to have the studies done. Can you imagine? My friends, now that we have lost General Brown, there's no one left in the entire United States government to help us. There are still many patriotic individuals in the government, of course, but they are not the ones in positions of power. Only massive public pressure, informed, angry, and determined, now has any chance of stopping the carefully planned war to kill millions of us and enslave the rest. Every one of us must work to bring about public awareness and pressure in whatever time we have left. But suppose we do not succeed, then what? I believe the time has come to face that question squarely and honestly. It may well be that we have already failed in our efforts to help prevent nuclear war I. Only God can know, but we dare not give up because the victory may yet be ours. But the fact is that many Americans do not want to listen. They are not ready, and some will not be ready to listen until catastrophe comes upon their heads. If nuclear war one does come here, my friends, millions will die, but there will also be some survivors. You owe it to yourself, to your family, and to our whole society to do whatever you can to be among the survivors. The godless dictatorship being fashioned by our unelected rulers will collapse in the end. And when it does, there must be people left who know what America was all about and what went wrong. Because you are willing to hear the truth now. Before disaster arrives, you are that people. And if we are all forced to pass through the dark tunnel of war and bungling dictatorship, it will fall your lot to help lead our people out of darkness and into the sunlight once again on the other side. My three special topics for today are: topic number one, how our national security was really lost. Topic number two, pre-war America, 1977. And topic number three, the end of an era. Topic number one. For more than a generation, since the outbreak of World War II, in fact, Americans have been preoccupied with the idea of national security. But what is national security? One concept of national security is the familiar one, promoted day in and day out by the federal government. According to the government, national security is a matter that is just too complex for most of us to understand and must always be wrapped in secrecy, intrigue, and more secrecy. When we see diplomatic maneuvers which seem to help our enemies while harming our friends or even ourselves, we're always told we simply don't understand the so-called national security considerations that are involved. The map of the free world shrinks ever smaller. Our country grows visibly weaker and weaker, yet the federal bureaucracy knows best, we are assured, and will take care of it all for us. But while you and I are both forced to pay the bill for it all, we are never, never let in on what it is really all about. What is called national security today by the government will be better described as security for our secret rulers. They see themselves as the embodiment of our nation, just as royalty did in times past. Thus, to them, so-called national security is nothing more than a king's X to prevent the public, you and me, from learning things about governmental doings that could endanger our ruler's security. Vital secrets that are routinely betrayed to our deadliest enemies are kept hidden from our view. The government's version of national security involves ever greater centralization of all power and all decision-making into just a few hands. Increasingly, it involves spying on the citizens of our own nation, and now it even includes diplomatic manipulations that have betrayed us straight down the road to nuclear war one. This is what the words national security really mean to those who secretly control the United States government, a government that used to be ours but is no more. What is called national security obviously is not what most of us naturally think of when we hear these words. The government's version of national security, in other words, is an illusion and a fraud. Real national security has to be rooted in the people who are the nation. When we think of national security, we usually think of the ability of the nation as a whole to protect itself from damage by other nations, politically, economically, and if need be, militarily. But there is another side to national security that is actually more basic. Yet we in America have been led to gradually neglect it and finally lose it altogether over the past 100 years or so. I refer to the internal stability that has been destroyed by over-centralization. Gone are the days when America consisted of thousands of communities, which could, if need be, survive for indefinite periods without supplies from distant sources. And gone are the days when consumers could choose from among a wide variety of products produced by true competitors. Instead, most of the things we now have for life come from somewhere else, often we know not where, and there is little competition or real choice left. The flow of essential commodities can now be turned off at will by the corporate socialists at a few central spigots in order to bring America to a grinding halt. Most Americans today never give this state of affairs a second thought. The young cannot imagine things being any different. And most of those who are old enough to remember a different way of life are willing to settle for what we have today with the comforts and luxuries that have become commonplace. What has happened, my friends, is that we have all become addicts. There is an addiction that underlies our entire way of life today. And this same addiction has made it possible for us to be brought to the threshold of totalitarian world government and nuclear holocaust. My friends, we are addicts. Addicts to energy. There's no precedent in history for the magnitude of the suffering man can now bring about. Because there's no precedent in history for the energy addiction that now grips America and the world. For thousands of years, mankind got by on the ancient and renewable forms of energy such as animal power, water power, wind power, and the burning of wood. Then came coal and the Industrial Revolution was spawned. But it was petroleum, thanks to its great convenience and high energy output, that was destined to make true energy addicts of us all. It is typical of addictions that they take time to develop. And that is true of our energy addiction of today. It began very gradually over 100 years ago and has built up over several generations. During the early years after petroleum first made its appearance, we were still in the take-it-or-leave-it stage, but gradually it found more and more uses, and then whole technologies were spawned which depend specifically on petroleum energy, such as the automobile and the airplane. These technologies gradually took on the character of necessities rather than optional luxuries, and from that point onward we were true addicts. The same way, our energy addiction expanded to include dependence on natural gas and electricity. Even our food production became increasingly dependent upon uninterrupted supplies of non-renewable energy. The American farmer, blessed already with a rich land, began to retire his ox-drawn plow in favor of a gasoline-powered tractor, and soon expanded his productivity still further with other farm machinery, all of it run by petroleum energy. It became possible for fewer farmers to feed us all, and farmers who failed to keep up with these new trends, whether for financial reasons or otherwise, gradually disappeared from the scene. Then came high-yield hybrid crops, petroleum derivative insecticides and fungicides to protect these delicate hybrids from damage, and fertilizers made with natural gas as a raw material in order to make them grow better. Farms became bigger, fewer, and more expensive. Huge agribusinesses, energy-intensive and geared for high productivity, began to dominate American agriculture, making it still harder for the small family farm to compete. Meanwhile, Petroleum energy made possible fast freight transportation over long distances. High-volume food distributors have exploited this in such a way that nearby small suppliers of many foods are bypassed in favor of a few centralized huge supply sources far away. This, of course, has caused many of the nearby supplies that used to exist in many areas to dry up and disappear. For example, every town of any size used to have access to one or more local dairies which processed the milk produced by cows in that area. But today, many of the familiar, dependable local dairies of the past are gone, and if you can find anyone who can tell you where the milk you buy comes from, you may well discover that it comes from a central processing plant in another state. We have now reached the point where practically all the necessities of life, including food and water, reach us only by means of non-renewable, centrally controlled energy. The energy pushers have done their job well, making it appear that nothing more than natural trends were at work. They have fed our addiction beyond the point of no return, taking care not to allow competing sources of energy to develop that could get out of their control and ruin their grip on us. Our energy addiction is now to be used against us for their own purposes. When we're told now that we must conserve, it means that we must knuckle under to sacrifices as we are gradually ground under the heel of artificial shortages and rising costs. My friends, the role of energy in our society is so all-pervasive today that it is hard to describe. And it is the Rockefellers who first realized how powerful a tool it could be for their own ends. John D. Rockefeller, Sr. built the giant Standard Oil monopoly with ruthless determination to corner the market on petroleum. The trust-busting era merely caused him to devise better ways to hide his control while his program proceeded without let-up. And soon the Rockefeller Standard Oil Empire became involved in international intrigue and wars to overcome foreign competitors as well. The process has continued down to the present, with wars, skirmishes, coups, and so forth enabling the Rockefeller Empire to maintain a stranglehold on most of the world's oil. In recent years, this has been made virtually airtight through control of most of the free world's refining capacity. So today, it is the four Rockefeller brothers who are in a position to turn off the vital energy supplies to which we have become addicted for our very lives. We have all become so accustomed to the steady supply of electricity, natural gas, and petroleum products that the illusion of reliability has been created. Alternative means of surviving by means of local resources have gradually fallen into the disuse and have disappeared, while we all have been lulled into a life or death dependence on centralized energy sources controlled by the Rockefeller brothers. And they are not interested in your security or mine. Their horizon is the world and how to control it, not the mere survival of America. Therefore, when they turn the energy spigots off, as they are beginning to do now, they will be turning off our national security with it. In other words, we have no national security. So long as the necessities of life remain under the centralized control of men who are determined to murder our beloved country, we will never again have true national security. Only if we the people will rise up and take back the government that has been stolen from us will the many things be done that are necessary to restore true national security to our land. Topic number 2. When I recorded my audio book tape on the coming depression and war in October 1974, I explained the real purpose that caused World Wars I and II. In both cases, Germany was nothing more than a huge pawn in an ever bigger game of international conquest. Instead, as I said then, through two world wars, America's secret rulers brought Great Britain to her knees. The American people as a whole feel strong kinship to the British. So it seems incredible that our secret rulers would have deliberately smashed Britain through war. But listen to what former Prime Minister Sir Harold Wilson said last month on January 22, 1977 on a television talk show. When he was asked to explain the economic crisis Britain is in, he said, quote, "Two world wars took all our investments. And the Lend-Lease Agreement with the Americans not only took all our markets, which was justified as we didn't want shipping going to Latin America, but we had to give them all our inventions," unquote. Thus, the three decades from the beginning of World War I to the end of World War II were used to concentrate the bulk of the world's economic might into the hands of those who ruled America secretly behind the scenes, namely the Rockefellers. The technologies and markets of friend and foe alike were stolen and poured into the coffers of the corporate socialist empire controlled by the four Rockefeller brothers. But this emergence of America into sudden world dominance was never intended to be more than a temporary phenomenon by those who had secretly caused it to happen. A dominant share of the economic and technological might of the world had been centralized under American control so that we could then serve as an immense reservoir for transfusions to the Soviet Union. The godless dictatorship set up by the Bolsheviks in Russia in 1917 with the help of Rockefeller financing was to be the real wave of the future. It represented the ultimate in monopoly, total control over every aspect of people's lives. But the Soviet system, which is intended as the pattern for total world domination, is artificial and unnatural, and that is why the Soviet Union had to be built up by massive transfusions from outside, transfusions of money, food, economic and technological know-how, everything. Now the transfusions are virtually complete. It took three decades to drain Britain and Europe to build up America as a reservoir for the Soviet Union. And it has taken three more decades to drain the American reservoir and make the Soviet Union the world's most powerful nation in material terms. The United States is now following Great Britain down the road to ruin, and for the same reasons. The Rockefeller brothers and their intimates now arrogantly believe they can no longer be stopped in their plan of world conquest. They are convinced there is no power greater than themselves, and they are becoming more brazen by the day.